excited to introduce is Donald McGilchrist. He is a citizen of the United Kingdom, born in London. Donald holds an MA in philosophy, politics, and economics, just all those three subjects, from the University of Oxford. With his lovely wife, Jeannie, and their two daughters, Donald immigrated in 1976 to Colorado Springs, where he served until very recently as International Vice President of the Navigators. He is now an international consultant for the same group. His interest in history has focused widely, but mainly on the ownership and development of Glen Eyrie and its founder, General William Jackson Palmer. Today, his program is entitled The Quest for the Best, General Palmer's Pursuit of Technological Innovation. Please help me in welcoming Donald McGilchrist.
Good morning. The quest for the best. Abraham Lincoln is known only to have given one lecture. His topic was discoveries and inventions. His conclusion was that here in America, quote, we discover and invent and improve faster than other branches of the human family on whom the dust of ages has settled. Lincoln could speak with a measure of authority as our only president to have taken out a patent, and it was for a device to lift stranded riverboats off the shoals. Lincoln also observed in his lecture that inventions were usually cumulative, and he would doubtless have agreed with Mark Twain, who said, it takes 1,000 men to invent a telegraph or a steam engine or a phonograph or a photograph or a telephone or any other important thing, and the last man gets the credit. We forget the others, but he added his little mite. That's all he did. Now this bears on our assessment of General Palmer, who assuredly was not a pristine inventor. Palmer acquired no patents. He was rather a pioneer who had a remarkable ability to secure the best counsel and employ the best people to flesh out his vision. He was a collaborative initiator. Contributing to Palmer's success was his skill at recruiting three types of men. Leaders from among his Civil War officers, engineers from his early railroad days, and investors from his many Eastern and European relationships. All were friends, and to these, in his final years, he added a stream of social and cultural leaders who came to enjoy his conversation and his home. My respect for his accomplishments began when we arrived in the 1970s. Our family came from London. London, as you know, is a city with 2,000 years of recorded history. And at first, in Colorado Springs, I felt a little short of historical oxygen. The Springs was still a rather small town, only a century old. But how intriguing, I decided, how intriguing to find out as much as I could about this place and about its fascinating founder. This morning I want to concentrate on Palmer's seminal experience as a young engineer and, after the Civil War, on the outworking of this in Colorado during his 30s. Given that Palmer was able to deploy large financial resources towards the end of his life, to what extent, one must ask, did he merely purchase innovation rather than stimulate it? Well, certainly this was not how he started. His family was neither wealthy nor among the social elite. Indeed, his father declared bankruptcy in the 1840s. Palmer grew up, as Leah Davis Witherow has ably demonstrated, in a ferment of innovation. The wharves and railroads and canals of in and around Philadelphia throbbed with new products, better means of bringing them to market. Philadelphia was then our second largest city, immersed in the tumult of the Industrial Revolution. He had that enterprising cast of mind that marked many Quakers in the 19th century. In Britain, for example, at the time of the Great Exhibition in 1851, Quakers numbered less than 0.1% of the population, and yet they were prominent leaders in banking, clothing, food, especially chocolate, and also engineering. And this was in spite of the residual prejudice against them, socially and spiritually. I think that, like a certain car company, rental company, it disposed them to try harder, and they did. Now, in the summer of 1855, aged 18, Palmer borrowed the fare from his uncle and set sail for Liverpool. He was eager to become conversant with the latest British technologies in mining, milling, and railroading. He was inquisitive, observant, analytical. He filled notebooks with his comments and his sketches. And he wrote articles for the Miners' Journal, which was a prominent Philadelphia periodical back home. His notebooks during this time in Europe describe ideas for processes that he wished to invent or to improve. After 6 months in England, Palmer moved on south to Paris, and he carefully examined the displays at the 1855 Exposition Universelle in Paris. And he was fascinated by what he called, quote, the perfection of continental machinery, unquote. Especially, he wrote, locomotives made in an absolute monarchy that would not have disgraced a republic, steam engines and pumps and spinning machinery invented under a despotic emperor that might put to the blush a free representative government. Well, this raises a nice question, doesn't it? How do our political arrangements influence our creativity? Just for consideration during the day. Anyway, Palmer then talked his way into the company of various French railroad engineers. He reports, quote, we conversed about coal and coke and locomotives and fireboxes and smoke burning and signals and single track railways. Now, this was not a theoretical thing to Palmer. He spent a number of nights on trains radiating out from Paris on the footplate of the locomotive, getting thoroughly dirty and working as a fireman and talking all the time and learning all that he could about French locomotive science. So he had this intense investigation lasting almost a year in England and France, immersed in industrial technologies. And I want to suggest that this left an indelible mark on him. Indeed, he already embodied what de Tocqueville, some 20 years ago, had described as a typical American, a person who lives in a land of wonders. Everything around him is in constant movement, and every movement seems an advance. Nowhere does he see any limit placed by nature to human endeavor. Choose any American at random, and he should be a man with burning desires, enterprising, adventurous, and above all, an innovator. I experienced this in spades when I came here. So different from my background and my culture. For example, you in your streets often have a first annual street barbecue. We would never do that in England. We assume that it won't work. So adventurous. Well, Palmer returned from Europe in 1856. He was still aged only 20, and he successfully experimented in converting locomotives in Pennsylvania from wood burning to coal burning. Then he served for several formative years as private secretary to J. Edgar Thomson, who was president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. And in this capacity, incidentally, Palmer worked closely with the young Andrew Carnegie and with others who would have bright futures. Now, in passing over Palmer's distinguished and daring service during the Civil War, which ended when he was still only 29, and bringing us to the late 1860s, the atmosphere at this time was one of much optimism, westward expansion, the idea of planting colonies within the air. Why? Well, young men had learned during the war that coming and acting together for a large purpose was satisfying, and they wanted to continue to adventure. The new railroads were aggressively recruiting settlers. The Homestead Act of 1862 was helping also. Palmer's unifying mindset, I believe, was that of an engineer. He exercised this in the coming years in fields as varied as surveyor, geologist, developer of mines and railroads and industries, urban designer, environmentalist, benefactor. He became surveyor for Thompson's Kansas Pacific Railroad in 1867, and he led a party that explored how best to reach the Pacific, taking care as he went to probe and assess the coal strata along the way and to fend off various Native Americans. He wrote a report, which has been published in 1868, describing how his party accurately surveyed almost 4,500 miles of potential routes from Colorado and Wyoming through to San Francisco. His survey photographer was Dr. William Bell, who became a lifelong friend. And then Palmer returned to Colorado and led the actual construction of the Kansas Pacific Railroad as it was coming into Denver from the east. And in that period of laying rails down for Kansas Pacific, it came to him that he would form his own company. He wrote to his fiancée, Mary Lincoln Mellon, whom he affectionately called Queen, and he said, "I had a dream last evening. How fine it would be to have a little railroad, just a few hundred miles in length, all under one's own control with one's friends, and to be able to carry out unimpeded and harmoniously one's views in regards to what ought and ought not to be done." Well, he did. In the next few months, his correspondence and his actions reveal him, one, discerning the unique advantages of a north-south railroad along the eastern edge of the Rocky Mountains, what he called the mountain base. Two, determining that it should be narrow gauge to access and colonize the mountains. Three, envisioning and planning how the coal deposits of Colorado could be harnessed. And last but not least, declining to seek government aid, either federal or state aid, for any aspect of his railroad. Now, none of these elements featured in the plans of other railroads who were competing and pushing to reach the California Pacific Coast. As an entrepreneur, Palmer knew that he had to capitalize his plans. Therefore, he established the Mountain Base Investment Fund, and this held title to tracts of land south of here along the entire future route of his railroad, which were likely to become townships. This fund was the parent of the Colorado Springs Company, which incidentally still exists and is the oldest company extant in Colorado. Capital for these projects would largely come from Palmer's friends in the East and from Dr. Bell's friends in Europe. In the first chapter of his recent book, Killing for Coal, Thomas Andrews documents Palmer's comprehensive vision for the lands that he was acquiring throughout Colorado, in which Palmer projected, quote, "the building of lumber operations, irrigated farms, cattle ranches, tourist resorts, town site developments, and other enterprises," unquote. Andrews argues that all Palmer's imaginings rested upon the coal outcrops of southern Colorado. I believe that is somewhat overstated, but it was an important factor for him. And one can say that Palmer's railroad interests and his mining interests advanced in tandem. They fed one another. the Denver and Rio Grande depended upon coal not simply for fuel, but also for freight. Palmer opened his first collieries in Fremont County in 1872, and expansion continued until his Colorado Coal and Iron Company became the largest coal operator in the Mountain West, and later built what was the only integrated steel mill west of the Missouri at that time. As an entrepreneurial engineer, Palmer relished the adventure of planning new towns. And he wrote to Queen. They were not married yet. She was his fiancée. He said, there was some music. Music in the inception of large material enterprise, which can be recognized by the mind, although not perceptible through the medium of the ear. Well, as regards the site of our town here, I would suggest that it wasn't easily perceptible by the eye either. The only point of potential interest this side of Colorado City was perhaps the confluence of Fountain and Monument Creeks. So Palmer knew that he had to persuade his future bride, Queen, of the joys of cultivating a wilderness. So he painted a glowing picture. There should be fountains, lakes, lovely drives, horseback trails through the groves, all planned and planted by ourselves, so that our home would grow up under our own eyes. Can you imagine anything more delightful? Life would be poetry, gives wing to the imagination, and allows no foothold for it to halt upon, short of infinity. You see, even engineers can be lyrical. In what Palmer himself was honest enough to call, quote, the general vacancy, unquote, that's where we are, Palmer mobilized rapidly to create an unusual and attractive city. He saw beyond the arid and featureless expanse. And I'm reminded of a nice quotation from G.K. Chesterton. The whole difference between construction and creation is exactly this, that a thing constructed can only be loved after it is constructed, but a thing created is loved before it exists. Isn't that beautiful? This was a created city. It was loved before it existed. Palmer saw it and wanted it. In late 1871, the diminutive trains of the Denver and Rio Grande reached Colorado Springs from Denver, where a fine depot was built here. And here's a picture of the first of his locomotives. And he weighed 20 tons. He then set up a promotional organization for this colony, this city, led by General Cameron and managed by Henry McAllister, both of them Civil War buddies. And things moved very fast. Palmer was an organizer. The first 160 structures were erected between August and December of 1871. And the energy that drove this infant settlement was quite remarkable. For example, Palmer's company platted 70 blocks, each 400 by 400 feet, laid out the principal avenues for the city, such as Nevada and Cascade, at a width of 140 feet. His purpose in doing this was to allow large carriages to turn around comfortably and not experience any difficulty or any attempt to back up. But it also, in 1898, almost 30 years later, prevented the great fire that consumed the Antlers Hotel from jumping Cascade Avenue and reaching the Central Business District. So that was very helpful. In this first year, he also built the El Paso Canal, 11 miles long. The idea would be there to irrigate the future gardens that hadn't yet been created. Very visionary. He planted thousands of cottonwood trees. He launched the Out West newspaper, which became the Gazette, and which he continued to own until 1896. He founded Colorado College and what is now the Colorado School for the Deaf and Blind. Now, despite all of this going on within the space of 18 months to 2 years, Palmer even found time to travel to California and sail south to Manzanillo. On the voyage, he met the future Mexican president, Porfirio Diaz, and after landing, he and his party traveled to Mexico City, where he began negotiations to build a Mexican railroad. Now, these were very protracted. Mexico happened at that time to be politically unstable, and in fact, his narrow gauge construction in Mexico did not begin until around 10 years later. But at the same time, coming back from that trip and subsequent trips, Palmer was founding and nurturing new Colorado towns. Sedalia, Castle Rock, Palmer Lake, South Pueblo, and with General Hunt, Durango, all of them initiated, launched, designed, as it were, platted by Palmer and his people. Other places such as Leadville, Montrose, grew rapidly when they were connected to his railroads and challenged by his energy. In this brief time, I've only been able to touch on Palmer's entrepreneurial launch of the first of his three railroads, the Denver and Rio Grande, and of this remarkable city, with just a glance at his mining and industrial interests. But I want to draw your attention again to the symbiosis, the synergy that existed between his mines and his steelworks and his railroad and his cities. They grew together. They fed off and connected with one another. Three other aspects of this fascinating man come quickly to mind. Aspects which, as it were, enhanced and amplified his contributions. First, his environmentalism. He was president of the International Society of Arboriculture, of tree lovers and tree planters. He was the founder, as you know, of our park system. He was the donor of 10,000 acres of Manitou Park, near Woodland Park now, to Colorado College. And he was a vigorous opponent of overhead electric wires, which we still have in some subdivisions, and of the smoky chlorination mills. His environmentalism. Secondly, his social philosophy. It was racially inclusive. He had African Americans on his staff from the beginning. He had warm relationships with Mexicans and with the Utes who used to come to Glen Erie. He was a culturally sensitive person. And thirdly, his industrial relations. Now cast your mind back to the late 19th century and you've heard of robber barons, railroad barons, people like Jay Gould. Palmer's industrial relations were excellent in an age of rapacious financiers. He never forgot the wretched conditions that he saw in English coal and tin mines. Indeed, he scrupulously followed his early promise to Queen that the Denver and Rio Grande would be, quote, quite a little family in which everybody should be looked after to see that there was no distress among the workmen and their families. Schools should be put up for them and bathhouses, there should be libraries and lectures, and there would never be any strikes, and there weren't, or hard feelings among the laborers towards the capitalists, for they would all be capitalists themselves in a small way. Now, there are indeed libraries and lectures, are there not? Palmer would be pleased. He would be pleased if he were here today. He was a man fortunate indeed in his choice of mentors, men such as Ellet and Thompson and Scott, and in the caliber of the men who were glad to be his colleagues. Now, it's not often realized, but he was frequently short of money. Sometimes he moved off Glen Erie and lived downtown in a moderately small house because it was very hard to keep on financing and fighting other railroads as well. So he was frequently short of money for his enterprises until he sold the Denver and Rio Grande Western, the Rio Grande Western Railway in 1901. But he never failed his staff. In the last decade of his life, he introduced innovation in almost every aspect of his beloved estate at Glen Erie. For example, he and his agent, Edmund Van Diest, constantly tested and pressed for more advanced and reliable turbines and generators for his power plant at the Glen. He was on direct current, unlike Tesla, sustaining an intricate correspondence with Dr. Milo, who became the president of the American Society of Electrical Engineers. He had a water engineer, Herbert Reed, who had also been a city engineer, and who built for Palmer a dozen reservoirs. Now, if you've been to Glenury, you don't often see the stream even wet. But a dozen reservoirs, engineer Reed, took from the subterranean water that flows throughout the year down Queens Canyon, out through the Glen, and sometimes in Camp Creek. 200 million gallons of reservoir. And he installed five impressive greenhouses built by Lord and Burnham, the best people of New York, from which his gardeners later won more than 50 awards. So in each of these improvements, we see, again, his quest for the best. He did launch, and he did stimulate, and he did purchase innovation. In summary, I think he exemplifies the famous thesis that Frederick Jackson Turner put forward in the 1890s, as he reflected on the ways in which pioneers such as Palmer had shaped and been shaped by participating in the advance of the frontier west throughout the 19th century. Turner argued perceptively that the frontier formed a practical, inventive turn of mind, quick to find expedients, a masterful grasp of material things, powerful to effect great ends, a restless, nervous energy, a dominant individualism, and a buoyancy and exuberance which comes with freedom. That's Palmer.
Steve Ruskin, our next presenter, who is a native of Colorado Springs. He holds a PhD in philosophy and philosophy of science and history from Notre Dame University. He's the author of John Herschel's Cape Voyage and numerous articles on scientific expeditions. His recent essays on Darwinians in the Rockies and the Eclipse of 1878 have both appeared in Colorado Heritage, the magazine of the Colorado Historical Society. His presentation today focuses on a topic that many of us have long wondered about, and it is entitled Science as Enterprise and Industry, the Monument Valley Park Geologic Section in Context. Please welcome Steve.
Thanks, Leah. The Monument Valley Park Geological Section is something that you may have seen as you're walking through Monument Valley Park, or you may have seen, I didn't realize what it was, but that's what I'll be talking today, and I'll put it in the context of today's symposium, which is Enterprise and Industry, or actually, I'm calling Enterprise and Innovation in the Pikes Peak region. And I want to answer three questions. Where the geological section is, in case you're not familiar with it, and I'll mention what it is too. Whose idea it was, and its ultimate purpose, and that's where I'll be putting it in the context of today's symposium. The geological section, where is it? Well, thanks to the satellite technologies that Rick Sturdivant described, this is a satellite view of Monument Valley Park. Here's Fontanero and Culebra coming up here. Here's that little parking lot that you've all probably parked in at one point or another when you went down there for a walk or a run. So here's one of the trails. Down here is that kind of pavilion area. And then beyond up here is that that small sort of depressed soccer field area. So that kind of pitch-oriented. The geological section itself is right here. You can't see it very well. And even if this were on your computer screen and it were a higher resolution, you can just barely kind of see a little bit of it. But what I want you to focus on, this is a giant tree here in bloom. It's green against a background of green, so it's not perfectly obvious, especially on this giant screen. But so picture this tree, or just sort of hold this tree in your mind. And that's this tree here. And so we're down on this field. Let's go back one. We're down here. This next image will be down here on this field. And here's the geological section here in the background. And then here's a close-up version. I took these just about two years ago. I think it was in October 2008 when I took these. Obviously the leaves were down, but you've probably all seen this. Does it look somewhat familiar to those of you who have been here at all? And did you ever know what it was? There is a plaque right there. So it gives a little bit of description. It says this geological, and they called it a column. It was called initially it was called a geological section. That was the initial way it was described, so I'm going to stick with the historical original term, but it's also been called a geological column, which is also, you know, an adequate description. But it's essentially a representation in stone of the geological layers that underlie the Pikes Peak region. So starting down here, and I'm not a geologist. In fact, online, a geologist caught me when I misspoke about 2 months ago. They filmed some of us presenters in anticipation of this symposium talking briefly for 4 or 5 minutes of our topic, and I said Paleolithic because I have some anthropological training, when I meant to say Precambrian, and some geologists went a little nuts, and I apologize to him. But when you're giving those brief talks, you know, you jumble up some words now and then, and unfortunately you don't often realize it, and you certainly can't go back and change it, so it is what it is. I am not a geologist, and I'll say that up front, but you've got the Pikes Peak Granites down here in the Precambrian period, working on up to the shales and limestones of the Late Cretaceous, and if I'm wrong, then I apologize. But and everything in between. So, but it is in stone, obviously, and it obviously wasn't, you know, this, it was built here in Monument Valley Park as sort of a sculpture, with much more purpose than just being merely sort of an aesthetic artifact. So anyway, whose idea was it? Well, following along, I think that absolutely fantastic presentation of Donald McGilchrist, almost anything in town of some historical nature that's with even, you know, in an arm's distance of William Jackson Palmer is typically attributed to him. And 99% of the time, it should be. You know, you wager a bet, you go walk around downtown and say, now, that was Palmer's idea. If you know, 99 times out of 100, you're going to be right, and you'll win the bet. So it's no surprise that the geological section has been attributed to Palmer. Monument Valley Park, obviously, was a park created and funded by Palmer and then donated to our city in 1907. So again, absolutely no... no one would fault you for assuming that the geological section was Palmer's idea, especially when the press, publications, tour guides, and the plaque on the column itself sort of hint that Palmer's hands are all over this. This little quote up here, and I know it's very blurry, I just sort of copied out of Google Books, but I'll read the, you know, it's from a 1997 book from Falcon Guides. It's the Walking Guide to Colorado Springs, and it states rather simply that the column was built between 1904 and 1907 at the request of General Palmer, who then gave it to the city. The plaque, which was affixed to the geological section in 1965, you know, it says Monument Valley Park Geological Section, layers of rock underlying Pikes Peak Region, blah, blah, a gift to the people of Colorado Springs from General William Jackson Palmer in 1907. And then here, an article from 1939 in the Gazette, I cut it off, but the keywords here are General Palmer's idea. The title here was Region's Geology Shown in Stone in Upper Monument Valley Park, General Palmer's Idea Seldom Seen by Region Residents. Even then, that was 1939, 60, 70 years ago. It was had already sort of faded into some obscurity, which I will attempt to resurrect and clear up the rest of my talk. But so anyway, you know, with this sort of weight of historical and press records weighing in on the side of General Palmer, it's no surprise that we all assume that the geological section was Palmer's idea. Donald McGilchrist also pointed out that Palmer was a very intelligent, very scientifically oriented individual. So he certainly knew his geology, I think, very well. I mean, even as an executive, as we might term him, he knew. He had to have some working knowledge of geology because he made a lot of money, you know, helping his trains blast through rocks, not necessarily himself, but he was very well-versed in all of the skills and techniques and technologies needed to run his railroad companies. In fact, however, the idea for the geological section was Edmund Van Diest, and I realized this as I was doing some work in the Colorado College Library's archives. They have a selection, or a big collection rather, of Van Diest's papers. Now, McGilchrist also, Donald, mentioned Edmund Van Diest as Palmer's, I think you said, agent. You can term Edmund Van Deest what you will. I've called him the project manager, chief engineer. He was sort of Palmer's right-hand man in many of Palmer's major projects, like Glen Eyrie, like Monument Valley Park. So he was right there working in conjunction with William, with General Palmer. But who he was, and why he had the background necessary to bring this geological section to light, I'll talk about next. But to sort of complete this particular section, and I think to sort of set the historical record straight, not that Van Deest was ever really buried or purposefully excluded. It's just the halo effect of General Palmer is so great that everything that sort of has been attached to any project he was involved with or funded, like Monument Valley Park, inevitably gets attached to Palmer. But the geological section was in fact Van Deest's idea. The two letters that I discovered in the Van Deest archives, I think will sort of clarify this. On the 12th of November in 1905, in the middle of, or kind of the first year or so, when Monument Valley Park was underway, the construction of it, Edmund Van Deest wrote to George Irving Finlay, who was a professor of geology at Colorado College, and a very, very important geologist for the Pikes Peak region back in the first part of the 20th century. And what Van Deest is doing is writing to him and saying, hey, we're planning this waterfall in a certain part of Monument Valley Park, and wouldn't it be neat to do a geological section right next to it? So here's what he writes. He says, "Dear Professor Finlay, in the north end of the park, Monument Valley Park, there will be constructed a waterfall with a height of 24 feet. I would like to make of the walls a sample geological section of our foothills, beginning with the granites and through the old red sandstone upwards. Will you, as you can, within that vertical limit, again of 24 feet, give me a section of the widths to be devoted to the rock from each layer?" In other words, he's saying, we're going to do this waterfall. Here's, you got 24 feet to work with. What proportion of each layer should we dedicate to you know, how, in other words, you know, normally if you went to see a geological section, which you can very easily do here in the Front Range, we're talking hundreds of feet if you were to see a good portion of it exposed. So it needs to be proportional, need to be reduced to fit within this 24 feet. Well, I didn't see the response from Finlay to Van Deest, but my guess is it came rather quickly and certainly with enthusiasm, because a professor of geology at Colorado College, which you remember from the map, Colorado College is just a few blocks away, to have this teaching tool, I would think would have thrilled Finlay, especially with Palmer being willing to construct it. So Finlay certainly wrote back very quickly, because 10 days later, Van Deest, armed with Finlay's response, then wrote to General Palmer and said, "Hey, I have an idea. What do you think?" And of course, you know, you can guess Palmer's response. But so on the 22nd of November, 10 days after Van Deest first wrote to Finlay, Van Deest now writes to Palmer. And this is where I think we have clear evidence that the idea was, in fact, the idea for the geological section was Van Deest's and not Palmer's. So the 22nd of November, 1905, "Dear General Palmer," begins Van Deest, and he begins diplomatically talking about progress is going well. "The work is progressing satisfactorily on the park. We now have 50 teams of animals, mules perhaps, and 100 men at work. Now I have from Professor Finlay a geological section of all the strata from the granite eastward to the Monument Creek or Pierce Shales. You know where that little waterfall is to be in the park? The drop is 30 feet. Within this height, there is room to place on both sides of the little waterfall, for a length of about 20 feet, this complete geological section, if you approve. It would be a unique and most instructive feature." And so clearly, Palmer did approve, and it was built. Interestingly, though, this letter indicates that Van Deest initially intended the geological section to be on both sides, which would have been, I think, really cool. And I don't think that ever happened. As it is now, if you go down there, it's just on one side, on the north side, essentially. And I can't imagine anything was built on the south side. It may have been possible, but I looked closely, and Judy's shaking her head, and Judy knows her stuff too. So I'll defer to Judy on that, but there's no signs of any construction on that, and that's fine, doesn't matter. So with the idea for the geological section established as Van Deest's, I want to explore for the rest of my time here what the actual purpose was. And to do that, we need to look at Van Diest's education. Van Diest was one of the first graduates of the Colorado School of Mines. He graduated in 1886. At Mines, he very likely received instruction from Arthur Lakes, who was one of the first professors of geology, or was probably the first professor of geology at the School of Mines. He's been called the father of Colorado geology. And if those of you who are familiar with the School of Mines know that the library up there is the Arthur Lakes Library. So he was an important figure for geology in Colorado at the end of the 19th century. Geology instruction, as you can imagine, was crucial for effectively mining mineralogical wealth. You can go out and dig at random, or you can have an understanding of geology and get a better sense of where you should dig to make your digging most profitable. And interestingly, as a side note, many of the first School of Mines students, possibly most, never actually received degrees. Van Diest did. He received what was called an EM, or it was a mining engineer's degree. But most of the students did not. They went there long enough just to get the skills needed to be able to be employed in the mining and milling industries. And this was of great concern to the early Board of Trustees. The School of Mines was often called the School of Assaying, and that was not that was a sort of derogatory term because assaying was merely the sort of technical skill needed to test ore to determine its mineralogical content and quality. And the one Board of Trustees report in 1878 noted with some disgust that, quote, "The first question asked by students upon entering the school is, how long shall I be required to study before I can assay or be of use to in a smelting or milling establishment?" In other words, they'd be there for a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years, and then they'd be off as soon as they had the skills necessary to seek employment. You can't really fault them because, you know, the School of Mines, of course, was established to help our state, well, territory and then state, develop and extract the mineralogical wealth and then become a more profitable state. And so, you know, those students who merely wanted to learn the basic skills, they can't be faulted, and certainly the school was doing its job in providing those skills. So, moving on. This is a section or an excerpt from a book called Prospecting for Gold and Silver by Arthur Lakes, by that important professor of geology at the School of Mines. This was published in 1895. Certainly Lakes was teaching when Edmund Van Diest was attending the School of Mines. I have no evidence that Van Diest took a class from Arthur Lakes, but it would be almost impossible to think that he did not. So I will assume that the sort of instruction that Lakes was giving in this book, which is almost kind of a, you know, popular guide to prospecting for anyone. It wasn't a technical manual. It was technical, but it wasn't a textbook. It was the equivalent of investing in real estate or the stock market, you know, for today's reader, and just as precarious, I would suppose, too. But Lakes described the importance of geological training to would-be prospectors. And what Lakes says here that I think would have been the exact sort of information that Van Diest would have received at the School of Mines, quoting from this book now, Lakes writes, "One of the first things for a prospector for gold and silver to acquaint himself with is the elements of geology. He can read this up theoretically in many excellent manuals and become learned in the names of eras and epochs. But let him not imagine that at the end of this process, merely by reading, that he knows geology. Geology can no more be learned by means of a book without field work and the actual personal contact with nature and rocks than chemistry can be learned without ever using a test tube. Instead, if he is near some mountain region, as in Colorado, where the whole strata of the Earth's crust is upheaved and exposed, let him take this book in hand and go to the very place described and pictured as a geological section, and with his hammer study each member of the section closely." And here's an actual sort of, I mean, it's not a picture, of course, but it's a drawing, presumably by Lakes, of the sort of geological strata that he's proposing that the would-be prospector go out and study, you know, get his or her hands dirty with. Lakes continues, "Minerals and metals of economic value, such as gold and silver, are more frequently found in the rocks of certain geological periods than others. For instance, nearly all the silver deposits of Colorado are found in a certain bed of limestone not over 200 feet thick, to be found only in one geological period out of many others.
It would naturally then be advisable for a Colorado prospector to be able surely to identify this limestone. In short, you want to strike it rich as a prospector, you got to know your geology. So looking again, I just wanted to, you know, you can kind of keep this in mind as I flip again to the geological section structured here in Mint Valley Park. In proportion, most of these layers appear to be represented there. A couple other things to note, the way, and I think this is to Van Dees' credit, rather very cleverly, now this lake did not exist. This was the field and tree that I showed in the recent photo, but this lake was there. Much of Mint Valley Park was destroyed, or at least reconfigured with the few floods we had at the beginning of the 20th century. So this lake obviously no longer exists, but you can see here's the geological section, here's Pike's Peak and the Front Range. It was actually tilted upward into the west, just as if it were part of the geological uplift. So, you know, Van Dees, I suppose, could have just had a flat horizontal, golly gee, here's the layers, but he made it look as if it were very much occurring in nature. And to add to that, when the waterfall was there, it gave this very dynamic sense that there was kind of, you know, some erosion going on, and almost as if this geological section had been exposed, eroded, carved away by the waterfall. So that was really neat too, and it did give it a very aesthetic sense. So conclusion, okay, so what? And I have a couple minutes left. Why does the geological section matter to the local enterprise and innovation, enterprise and industry, particularly the mining industry of the Pikes Peak region 100 years ago? Well, I think Van Dees knew that geology was queen of the sciences for the Pikes Peak region. We were, 100 years ago, a very extraction-based economy. I mean, sure, we had tourism and those sorts of things, which came a little bit later, but at the end of the 19th century, the first part of the 20th, from 1859, the first Pikes Peak gold rush, really to the end of the Cripple Creek gold era, we were, in large part, a mining-based economy. So much so that, here in 1875, an ad in the Gazette, this is 1875, Colorado is not even a state yet, and it's 30 years, you know, before Van Dees is building, but there's these recurrent ads, you can go see these, for a mining institute of Colorado Springs, where just local residents are offered for, you know, between 60 and 120, let's see, 620 to 160, you know, in today's terms, that's $100,000 even, to take classes, to prepare them to go out and take advantage of the local region's mineralogical wealth. They could take classes in assaying, in blow piping, and in metallurgy. So I'm basically out of time, but to conclude, I think the geological section, now almost buried in obscurity, is much more than just a geological training tool that Van Dees put up. It's certainly that, but it's much more. Because at the time, if we go back, I mean, look at what a central feature it is of Monument Valley Park. It's not just off to the side. I mean, it's right here next to the lake, but there's bridges, there's overlooks, and you can still go to these overlooks. They don't have the cool wooden log railings, but it was a very central feature of Monument Valley Park. And it was a monument in a true sense of, I think, reminding us, reminding those who were around 100 years ago that it was geology that really was driving the economy. I was sort of likening it. I lived in Berlin for a while, and I would go to East Berlin and see those remaining statues, which are almost hokey and corny of the, you know, the communist, you know, family. You know, it was, in other words, it was the individual who was the supposed driver of the economy in the Marxist system, and they were glorified. And I think in a way, you know, when you look at the sculptures that are placed in capitalist societies, and I'm not trying to make any political point other than, you know, geology was really being held up here in this sculpture, if you will, by Van Dees as an important driver of the mining industry that did underlie our economy back then. So much so that the Smithsonian Institution even lists it as in their registry of American sculptures. So anyway, if you go, I do want you, go back out, see it. Go, it's summer now in Colorado Springs. You can walk down there and you'll have a much more informed interpretation of what that is. And maybe when we get some money back in our budget, we can start to clean things up a little bit. Let's keep our fingers crossed anyway. Thank you.